Welcome to our podcast, Kuehne+Nagel Shipping Insights, Sea Freight News and Supply Chain Solutions. My name is Sarah Vollmer, and I'm pleased to be your host today. Sea Freight has been a part of me for over 18 years, and I currently serve as Vice President, Sea Freight Go-to-Market Strategy for Kuehne+Nagel in New York. The logistics and supply chain industry has been experiencing exciting times, and we have witnessed heightened global awareness of our industry since the onset of the pandemic in 2020. Our podcasts are aimed at not only providing information, but also offering insights for navigating these exciting times from a group of our experts. And today we're talking about the history of container shipping. Yes, there actually is a history behind this whole wacky world that we all live in here in the world of sea freight. And with me today is my special guest, Bill Rooney, who's the Vice President of Strategic Development for Sea Logistics, Kuehne+Nagel North America. Bill, thank you for coming on to our show.
It's great to be here. It's a great program, and looking forward to having a chat.
All right, so let's dive into it, because I'm sure some people are thinking, history? Well, how is a history even interesting of container shipping? So where did it all begin, though? How did this box, in essence, transform our lives? Where did it start?
Well, before I say anything about that, I would say up front that it's important for everybody who listens to this, everybody who works for our company, to understand the history. You're going to work in this business, it's helpful, and beyond being interesting to know the history of the business. But where containerized shipping really started was in 1956. I guess I would call it an innovation rather than invention. Of containerized shipping. It was started by a fellow named Malcolm McLean, who was a trucker from North Carolina, ran a trucking company, who had the idea of, when he looked at the older way of moving cargo by ships, which was cranes and slings and a lot of longshoremen with hooks and that kind of thing. He looked at it and said, boy, there's got to be a better way to do that. And the better way was to basically lift truck bodies. He was a trucker, to lift truck bodies full of cargo from the pier to the vessel, or from the vessel to the pier. And he started the company, and the first sailing via a vessel called the Ideal X sailed from Newark, New Jersey, to Houston with 58 containers of cargo. And it was shipped, and the Ideal X was a converted tanker where they put a platform on top of the ship, and all of the 58 containers rode on top of this converted tanker. Okay. That was the beginning. And it's interesting to note that it took 10 years. In 10 years later, in 1966, Sealand went international and began services to both North Europe and Asia.
Okay. So why do you think it took 10 years in that span of the, let's call it, the ideation of a container, right? To then go from a domestic product to an international product.
Yeah. My gut reaction is, in reality, that's not so long, 10 years. It's a good question. Why didn't it take 5 or even 2? Right. Because it was such an incredible innovation, but it just took time for people who are used to doing. People necessarily don't like change necessarily. And you had to have different kinds of ships, right? You had to have cranes in the port. You had to have a lot of things that backed up the system. And I think that also took some time. The original ships had cranes on board the ships and that kind of thing. But you had a lot of considerations, not just, just the concept, but then you had to have the right ships. You had to have the longshore labor that could do it. You had to have the right terminals with cranes and that kind of thing. So it took some time.
Took a minute. Dare I ask, before we go further, where were you at this time?
I was wearing, as I said at some of my sessions, high-top PF Flyers in the 50s. So in 1956, I was 7. So I was not working yet.
No, and not worried about this.
Not worried about it. I got into business in 73. So it was still in its infancy. Even when I got in, the ships were much, much, much smaller. In those days, I was writing financial proposals to build new ships that had 1,200 boxes on them or 1,800 boxes on them, not 23,000, 24,000 boxes like they have today.
Right. So you mentioned Sealand here was the first with the international routes. Would you tell me a little bit more about Sealand?
They
again, the company originally was named Pan Atlantic Steamship. Malcolm McLean bought a company called Pan Atlantic Steamship. They pretty early on changed the name to Sea Limpies. That's what he was selling.
Okay.
He named it after the product, right? It was sea and land service. And they, I tell you, they had a lot of people who had been in the trucking business. And like I said, I worked for them for about 25 years. And I knew and still know some people who were there at the beginning.
Okay.
And he hired very, very good people, very talented people, and who were aggressive all pushing that concept forward.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. So in your perspective, how did this change the world? I mean, it did change the world,
yep.
Right? So what are some of the aspects of this?
I should say up front is, without a doubt, and this is not an exaggeration, there are few things in the history of anything that have changed the world as much as containerized shipping has. And I think people that work in this industry and specifically for our company, I think should understand that. A remarkable, remarkable change to the world. And it's sort of like the change when the world went from sailing ships mm-hmm. to steam-powered ships. Think of that difference where the difference that made. This made as much of a difference in the business, and that business thereby, you know, changed the world. And I think the most graphic change, what happened in Western Europe, largely the wealthier countries, Western Europe and North America in particular, what happened over a long period of time, what transitioned to the other parts of the world were manufacturing, basically. Okay. And best example is China becoming the manufacturer of the world, but not just China, but a lot of other places. And the most, I think, eye-popping statistic is if you look at, there's a standard statistic that UN uses, another organization uses, the number of people who live and have lived in abject poverty.
Okay.
And if you look at, I've seen these charts are pretty common, and you look at a chart that, say, starts in 1990 and ends 2019, 2020, over that period, about 1.5 billion people moved out of being in abject poverty. Abject poverty was defined as remarkably as living on $2.15 a day or less.
Okay.
And you say, well, what happened here? Yeah. Basically, this is people in China. It's based not China. It's Eastern Asia and South Asia. So you're talking China and Korea and Japan and Vietnam, and then you have the subcontinent. And about 1.5 billion people moved, you know, out of abject poverty. And that was, it's not entirely, but a big, big part of the that enabled that was containerized shipping, because you could now produce things outside the United States, outside Western Europe, at a much lower cost, and move them quickly, reliably, safely, at a reasonable cost to the destination markets in North America and Western Europe and elsewhere. It's really remarkable stuff. And everybody who works in this business should be proud of the fact that they're working in a business that accomplished something like that,
right,
which is really amazing.
Right. Is that trajectory, is it still in effect today, would you say, or at the same rate?
It's a great question. And it's changing because the world has changed, mm-hmm. right? What has happened is, obviously, China is still very, very large in terms of its manufacturing capability, but for a variety of reasons, risk mitigation, lower wage costs, it has spread. A lot of it has spread to Southeast Asia. You're talking Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, places like that, and other places in the world, whether you're talking parts of Africa, South America, where various companies have gone to search out better economics or just as importantly, more markets.
Right.
And so it's changed over time, and it's continuing to change, where now you're seeing more, I would say, intra-regional development,
okay,
as opposed to inter-regional development. So you see higher growth rates in intra-regional in Asia, that kind of thing. But it's still, you know, the containerized shipping is still supporting all of that and helping all of that that activity take place at somewhat lower growth rates, mm-hmm. but it's still happening, and it's enabling advances economically and for the people involved in various countries as it has over the last 50 years.
Right. So what's your take? So in the last, you know, call it 5 years, I mean, of course, we've been talking about it even longer than that, but the whole concept of nearshoring, right,
yeah,
has really come into play. And, you know, you take the EU as an example of being able to source and produce products
out on the eastern edge and whatnot. And that, I mean, isn't that going to have an impact here to the containerized shipping industry?
Yeah, I think the first thing you can see is the average distance of a move has been going down.
Okay.
So, you know, for at the beginning, right, I mean, the story I tell customers is when I was a little kid in the 50s and I had my high-top brown Pia Flyers,
yes.
You know, they basically had a supply chain that was 155 miles long from Boston to a town I lived in Connecticut. But when I was buying the same kind of items, athletic shoes for my kids in the 80s, mm-hmm. They basically, the supply chain then was 8,000 miles. What's been happening more recently, as you have more intra-regional development in Asian places like that, what we've seen is it doesn't mean the numbers, the long distance numbers are really going down. They're growing at a somewhat lower pace.
Okay.
The shorter distances are growing at a somewhat faster pace. So you see somewhat of a reduction in the average length of a cargo move. And that's not a bad thing. It's just indicative of these further development in the various regions of the world where you have this growth in intra-regional trade as opposed to the longer distance inter-regional trades.
Okay. What would you think Malcolm Klein would say today about the state of supply chain and containerized shipping?
That's a great question. you know, I don't know. I mean, he was a great businessman, changed the world like few other people have. I think he would like what he's seeing. I think he would like the fact that what I've talked about before about how it has changed the world in a very positive way.
Right.
I think he would appreciate that. And like I said, I worked with people who knew him personally. He was on the board of directors when I started at Sealand, and I know people that worked for him. Mm-hmm. And interesting, very interesting fellow, sort of a big thinker. I think he would be proud and happy with it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit here in our kind of our final segment about the financials behind this industry, because I think that's something, you know, when I'm talking to customers or when you're talking to customers, there's always something going on. You know, the last few years, right, we've seen some bankruptcies. There's been consolidation.
Right.
And there was a lot, and I think for the most part, there's been a lot of kind of, dare I say, mystery behind, you know, how are these guys and gals making money? And then, of course, there was the last couple of years, which were just crazy times all around. But how does some of this work? I know there's actually some governments that are involved, right, with some of the carriers. And how did this come about, and why did this come about?
I would say up front that the ocean carrier, containerized ocean carrier business, has a very long history of very poor financial results. And by financial results, I mean the return on the invested assets, operating margins, that kind of thing. So that's number one. Obviously, that changed remarkably in the last couple of years. A very, very different, obviously, performance in the last couple of years. But for most of the industry's history, almost all of it, very, very low-level financial returns. In large part, I would say for a couple of reasons, I'll mention two. One, it's at the ocean carrier level, it's a commodity product.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Customers do not see a distinction between carrier A, B, C, D, and they don't see a distinction they're worth paying for. This is what you in economics you would call a very competitive and efficient market that reaches equilibrium rates very quickly every day. So what you don't have in this business is any kind of excess profit for any reason at all, because it's a very efficient market.
Okay.
So what then happened is you over still today and over time from the beginning, you've had governments heavily involved in the business. So even today, you have the Chinese government with Costco and OOCL. The Korean government is the major equity holder in HMM. The Taiwanese government is heavily involved in Yang Ming. The French government has been involved in this business. You could go down the list, and whatever is not government-owned has been family-owned. And those two kind of entities really, more so the governments, don't make financial decisions the same way publicly traded companies make it, where they're trying to maximize return or customer or shareholder value.
Mm-hmm.
They may be making legitimate, you know, if you're a government who's a big exporter, let's say like China,
right,
it's a legitimate reason to be involved, I would guess, and to a certain degree. And I would say from their perspective, they're they over years were creating this factory to the world, and I'm sure very close to the top of their list of requirements was to make sure there was adequate capacity to move their products from origins to their many destinations around the world. Adequate capacity at reasonable or low rates. So what happened is you had a lot of over. The industry has been plagued from the beginning basically with overcapacity. And with overcapacity, what do you get in this business? You get lower rates.
Right.
And that's what produced over many, many, many years, these very low returns. Their operating margins over many years ranged between, believe it or not, negative 3% and positive 3%. I tell people all the time, at customers, any individual, including the two of us,
right,
if those were our KPI, personal KPI performances, we would be fired on the spot. So they've had very poor performance. Now, that's obviously changed radically in the last couple of years, but that's what's happened over many years. And it's sort of not surprising. I mean, it's a little like if you think back to the airline business. The airline business was just like that for many, until it got deregulated. Airline business was a horrible business to be involved in financially because they were all run by the governments, which were making decisions for different reasons. And they weren't out there to maximize shareholder value. So you ended up with really pretty disappointing financial results. But that's been the truth in this business. But obviously the last couple of years, it's been very, very different with operating margins north of 50%, which is beyond private equity, beyond hedge fund margins.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So, you know, Bill, you've been in this business a minute.
Yeah.
So to say. And you've had a variety of different roles, and you do speak like an economist, right? You are an economist by
choice. I have 2 degrees in economics, a bachelor's and a master's degree. I actually taught when I was in graduate school.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Well, I was a teaching assistant when I was one of these very lowly paid people who teach economics, and I taught basic economics 101, 102, which is microeconomics and macroeconomics for the 2 years I was in graduate school. So I started, the first job I had was actually doing economic research for the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Oh.
I did that for 2 years, yeah.
Okay, all right. So, you know, where do we go from here? So we've had a great talk here on the history in terms of where did this get started? You know, how was the world impacted? And a little bit of just, you know, of more information on the financials. What happens next?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that's like the $64,000 question that many people have, customers have, we have internally. And it's a topic I cover in the various events I'm involved in with customers. You know, is the business has gone through a near-death experience, basically,
right,
for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So if the business, and by that I mean carriers, third-party logistics providers like ourselves and owners of cargo who ship it, have all gone through this near-death experience. And the big question is, okay, has the industry been affected by that? And I don't think anybody knows. I can talk to both sides of that argument saying, yes, it's going to be different. You're going to have, you know, fewer carriers, not beyond what we have, but relative to further back history, there's fewer carriers. There are only like 10 that make, you know, their material size. In the business, there are no longer 5 alliances. There are 3, that kind of thing. The carriers have now broader revenue streams. They're carriers, they're operating terminals. Some of them are operating 3PL businesses. So that sort of speaks to, yeah, it'll be different. But I can also speak to the fact that the industry is entirely family or government owned, which makes it different.
Right.
I think if you look at what's happened to the rate levels, for example, in the Trans-Pacific business and the business from Asia to Europe, they fell off a cliff, which indicates that, okay, this age-old problem in the industry of overcapacity hasn't really changed. But again, on the side that it may change is the carriers have been, not in maybe those instances, but they have gotten somewhat better at real-time capacity management via blank sailings. So if they can get their act together there and do a better job as they were headed in that direction pre-COVID, if they can do a better job of real-time capacity management via this, you know, blank sailing process, they might change. And the change is going to be higher rates, you know, because the rates have been traditionally very, very low. And the big change, the end result of a possible change, I think, will be somewhat higher rates in the future than we had pre-COVID.
Okay. I think our audience just all took a collective gasp.
Well, but keep in mind, keep in mind, if you look at the assets involved, the ships, the container, I mean, a ship costs $125 million, $150 million. If you look at the assets involved and you look at history, you can say the carrier, I think the carrier cost of capital has more traditionally been about 10%. So that's the cost of your debt and your equity. But the returns on those assets have been 3 or 4%. So back for 50 years on average, customers, people who buy space from carriers have been getting a 6 to 7% discount. Now, that doesn't mean we should feel sorry for the carriers. It's just a fact. It's a fact of life that ourselves and people who buy container space have been getting a discount. And I think it's, again, it doesn't mean we need to do anything different. It's just, but I think it's helpful to understand that we have been getting a discount, and that may put us in a position of better appreciating where things may go in the future. And if the carrier returns go from 3 to 4% to 6 or 8, that's going to be a problem, because it's going to mean quite a bit higher rates.
All right, so I will leave it on that note. Bill, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you here on our podcast series. So today's episode, we were talking about the history of container shipping. Bill Rooney, thank you very much for joining me.
That was great. I really enjoyed it. It's an important topic, and I hope the folks who listen to it enjoy the conversation.
Great, me too. So everyone, please be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and our other channels to find out when our next episodes will be dropping. Stay tuned.